This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. Hey, what's up? It's Dean Bakari. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Today, I'm excited because I've got a guest here on the show. His name is Daniel Coyle. He's a journalist and New York Times bestselling author of several different books, one of which we'll be discussing in today's episode. It's called The Talent Code, and it's all about, you guessed it, how to unlock your full potential, how to unlock your talents, how to tap into your true skills and talents and bring them to light in your daily life, both personally as well as professionally. So let's dive right into the interview and welcome Dan to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So first question I've got for you is, I mean, all your books are written about the subjects of talent and skill and kind of helping people tap into their highest potential. What kind of got you into that whole domain in the first place?
You know, if you were to sort of, I guess, two answers, I mean, literally, it was in this area, I got a little newspaper clip back in the old ancient days when we actually had these clips from newspapers. I got a clip about a place called Spartak, which was a tennis club outside of Moscow that had produced more top 20 women players than the entire United States. And I looked in a little bit more, and it turned out they only had one court, one indoor court. And that idea that there were that many champions coming from this tiny, tiny place, really, I kind of got obsessed with it. And I started visiting these places around the world. You know, we sort of casually know of, oh, that little island in the Dominican where the shortstops come from, and that place in Russia where all the tennis champions come from, and that place where all the ballerinas come from, that place where all the genius computer coders come from. I started visiting those places and looking at the patterns of behavior, the way that they learn, looking at those environments, looking at the way they teach and learn in those places. And the second answer, I guess, the more personal answer is, I grew up with a brother 1 year older and a brother 1 year younger. And so I grew up always obsessed with the question, how do I get a little bit better than those two guys? Channel through which I got obsessed.
Well, it looks
this.
Like you've kind of figured out a few different ways to get yourself better than your brothers.
Yeah, don't tell them to read this stuff, actually.
So in writing this book, though, so you traveled all around the world. You went to these different talent hotbeds to try to figure this whole thing out, to figure out what it takes to really get awesome at something, to become extraordinary, to be world-class at a talent, at a skill, at a specific endeavor. Like, so what's the big thing? What's the thing that you found out? What's the shocker?
You know, there's a few different answers to that, but the biggest one, I think, has to do with the way the brain gets better at stuff. Mm. Old story of talent that we're told by Nike commercials and that we're told by plays and books and movies is that talent is a gift. You know, the babies are born with a gift, and that is, right. It's the most beautiful story. It's like this incredible, amazing story that there's a little baby in a diaper and that baby is Michelangelo or it's Michael Jordan. And to think that we might have that magic inside us is addictively fun and cool to think about. But when you go visit these places that are actually those performers, they're actually doing something really different. You know, they are training in a very particular way. They're spending time on the edge of their ability. Mm. They're spending time on the edge of their ability. They are struggling in very targeted ways where they are going to the edge, failing, reaching again, and failing again, and reaching again, and making it. And that zone, which is called the sweet spot, scientists would call that the sweet spot on the edge of your ability, is where improvement happens. It's literally where your brain gets rewired. And those, here's kind of the, I guess if you're looking for kind of the cool insight moment, those mistakes you make aren't really mistakes. because they are the points on the map that navigate you toward the solution. They are literally in your brain. Making that reach and failing literally gives you a spot where you should connect your brain. It shows you the way. It shows you the path. So creating cultures, creating environments, teaching in ways that get people to the edge of their ability and then help them repeat and reach and repeat is where skill gets built. And it sort of gets consolidated in this idea of the sweet spot and of a term that I never heard before, high-velocity learning.
High-velocity learning.
We don't think of learning as having a velocity, but it actually does. It actually really, really does. There are certain moments in your day where you learn a huge amount. Right. And this was really captured for me in a story that I tell on the first pages of the book. It's such an incredible story. There was this girl named Clarissa, and she was learning how to play the clarinet. And she was part of this big study done by this brilliant Australian scientist named Gary McPherson. And they captured her practice for like 20 years, for 15 years, from when she was 7 to when she was about 22. They captured her practice and they were able to isolate the points where she improved the most, which is a really fundamental basic thing. And what they ended up finding is that there are these certain areas where she would go to the edge and struggle and make a mistake and feel that mistake. Mm. And when you really look at what that looks like, it's kind of ugly. You know, there's a great 5 minutes that are captured in this study where she's trying to play this new song and plays a couple notes and she feels that mistake. And it's almost like there's electricity being shot through the keys of the clarinet. Like she flinches and she feels it. And it's painful. It's like a painful, struggling, slightly embarrassing place to hang out. But that is the place where her learning velocity goes up 10 times. She learns more, as I relate in the story in the book. She learns more in 5 minutes than she would learn practicing the other way, a shallow way, for a month. So if you learn what, you know, and the term that we use here is deep practice, that if you can practice deeply and spend time reaching and repeating on the edge of your ability, that's where you are literally growing that skill.
So in other words, it's – and I've read this in other books as well before. I think it was David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell where he wrote about this study where they basically kind of had two groups of students that were doing the same – you know, that were on the same level. One group had to read – you know, take a regular test, a regular quiz with very easily readable, simple font that was clearly written. They could read all the questions and just answer them, just like anybody would take a quiz, right? And then the second group took the same quiz, but the font and the writing on that paper that they were taking the quiz on was like way lighter. It was like light gray. So you had to squint to read the questions. Right. And I was so surprised. As it turns out, they did, you know, whatever percentage better just because they had to work a little bit harder at actually reading the questions, which I suppose kind of forced them to think a little bit harder, put in more effort into developing their answer. And then, you know, they did better, which was really interesting.
Exactly, Dean. I got the sweet spot. And you see that same pattern at every single one of these talent hotbeds around the world, and it's not an accident. I mean, think about it in terms of the way our bodies are built and our muscles. Like when you go to the gym and you work out, you go to the edge of your ability. Like you stress your muscle to the edge of what it's capable of, and your muscle responds by getting stronger.
Right.
Our brain is built exactly the same way. So that if you want to get better at some cognitive skill, if you want to get better at selling stuff, if you want to get better at chess, if you want to get better at communicating, if you want to get better at pattern recognition, whatever it is, there's only one place you need to hang out, and that's at the edge of your ability. And the kind of other level of irony here is it does involve a lot of struggle, and it involves a lot of repetition. And struggle and repetition are two things that have terrible reputations in our culture. Like when that happens to us, like we sort of have an allergic reaction. You know, struggle is embarrassing and it's hard. And repetition has this reputation of being just drudge work and just being, you know, just unnecessary repetition. But it's not actually. Repetition and struggle are really beautiful, you know. And if we reflect on the areas of our own life where we've become good at stuff, we will undoubtedly find that there are these sort of little places where it's because we've been out of our depth. It's because we've been willing to, for whatever emotional reason or whatever cultural reason, to spend time in that sweet spot and endure that you know, and endure that, and not just endure it, but to kind of capitalize on it and turn it into something positive.
Yeah, I remember you wrote something about how even being enthusiastic about sucking, even being enthusiastic about being bad at something, is incredibly helpful and you know, allowing you to develop that skill, which I thought was really interesting because it's so
struggle is not an option, right? Struggle is a biological requirement. You know, it really is. So the question becomes, how can we put ourselves in a place to have those kind of productive struggles?
So basically what all this comes down to, and you talk about this a lot in the book, is the more you fire off these circuits, right? Whether when you mm-hmm. when you practice at something, when you do it repeatedly over and over and over again, you're building up this thing called myelin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can yep. you talk about that a little bit? Because and the other interesting thing is that before I read your book, I'd only kind of heard it and heard about myelin in passing a couple of times.
Yep.
But
yep.
it seems like it's a pretty recent discovery, right?
It's a fascinating story. I mean, like you, I had heard the term myelin sheath in my biology class and was familiar with, mm-hmm. with the idea. Basically, myelin is this, it looks just like electrical tape, and it wraps the wires of our brain. And,
right.
and its function is just like electrical tape. It's this insulator, right? And you have insulation for the same reason that, you know, our computers, our cords, everything's insulated, because if it wasn't insulated, the signal would leak out.
Mm.
So we have that reason. So for many years, myelin wasn't studied because who studies the insulation? Like, it just looks boring and it looks inert. It turns out it's not inert. It changes, and it changes in response to intensive practice. They've actually done these brain scans where they'll measure the myelin in the appropriate parts of the brain for, say, a piano player. And one piano player will practice 100 hours. The other will practice 200 hours. And the myelin growth in those areas of the brain will be proportional to the number of hours that they practice.
Mm.
So every hour earns you a little bit of myelin. And here's where kind of the cool part is. As that myelin gets thicker and it wraps, it gets thicker and thicker and thicker around the neuron, around the wire, the signal speed goes up. And it doesn't go up a little bit. It actually goes up a ton. If there's no myelin around a neuron, around a wire, the signal goes 2 miles an hour. If it's 50 layers deep and some myelin gets 50 layers deep around a wire, it goes 200 miles an hour. The signal speed goes up
oh, wow.
by a factor of one. So as I met several neurologists as I did the research for this book, and one of them said to me, look, this stuff is broadband. It's like human broadband, all human skill. You know, we talk about muscle memory. Muscles don't actually have any memory. All of it is circuits, and all circuits are wrapped in myelin, and myelin is broadband. So the more you operate on the edge of your ability, reaching and repeating, the more myelin you earn, the more speed you earn, the more accuracy you earn, the more skill you earn. So it sort of takes our notion of practice from being sort of this drudgery, like, oh, I've got to go do an hour of practice, to being this sort of incredible construction site, you know, this incredible construction opportunity. You know, and we've always – it's been interesting to sort of look back at the wisdom of the ages and see how it aligns with this new science.
Mm.
And so there's a great quote from Aristotle. I think it goes something like, we are what we repeatedly do.
Yeah.
Excellence is not an act but a habit.
Yeah,
you know?
I love that quote.
That's myelin, you know?
Yep.
That's
so true.
About.
That's crazy.
So it kind of provides – I think for many – of us, it kind of provides a visual to sort of visualize that happening. You know, when we, again, to go back to the kind of comparison to our bodies, when we work out, we see the benefit. You know, we instantly look, you know, we look stronger, we mm-hmm. look thinner, whatever it might. And our cognitive, to have that model as you are sort of practicing, as you're spending time in that difficult, struggle-filled spot at the edge of your ability, there's some pretty cool stuff happening. And to simply have that visual in there is a kind of a useful thought.
Yeah, it's kind of like we don't see, even if you're trying to make a huge physical change, oftentimes you don't really see that. You don't see the huge strides that you make day by day every time you go into the gym. If you're, you know, 50 pounds overweight, you don't usually notice the weight coming off until you look back like 3 or 4 or 5 6 months later, and you're like, whoa, I dropped that much weight. You know, it's we oftentimes don't notice it day by day when we're in the trenches. So it's really neat. So you also talk about, so you've got deep practice, you've got two other things that you say are really important, ignition and then coaching, right? Ignition and coaching. I'd like to kind of dive into that a little bit also, if we could. So ignition is all about motivation, right? That's the part of your book that is all about kind of igniting your passion and getting really, really, you know, enthusiastic and excited about doing those things that you need to do to build up more myelin and to focus on that deep practice. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You bet. Yeah. I mean, it sort of stems from that fact that, look, what's going to make, you know, if it takes being in the sweet spot, which of course feels crappy to be struggling on the edge, if you're going to spend a lot of time there, what's going to get you there? What is going to make you get there? And what science and visiting these talent hotbeds shows the same pattern, which is basically what gets you there is having a full windshield, having a vision of your future self that you can stare at. You know, human beings have been around for a long time, and we learn by staring at who we want to be.
Yeah.
That's how the motivational system works. If you get an opportunity to really seriously contemplate and really seriously stare at someone who you don't just admire, you don't just sort of appreciate, but someone that you want to become, that you link your identity to their identity, that's where you tap into a whole nother level of unconscious motivation. And in the book I talk about, there's a bunch of cool experiments that show how that happens. A quick way to explain it is to relate the fact that when you look at the fastest people, fastest runners in the world, they average in birth order 4 of 5. They average the 4th of 5 children. There are no firstborns in the fastest 10 runners in the world. The same is true with NFL running backs. The same is true with stolen base leaders in baseball. And the same is true with musical groups of families. You know, who's the best Jackson brother? It's not Tito, you know?
Right. So in other words, what you're saying is that the ones that end up becoming the best and excel have, in this sense, a role model to look up to that inspires them, right? That shows them that it's possible, in other words?
Exactly. Their windshield is full and their identity is lit up and connected, and they've got a vision of their future self. It goes even beyond the idea of a role model. It goes into this sense of deep, deep identification with this person in the windshield. And when you have a talent hotbed, when you have one person succeed, when you look the next year, there's 3, and you look the next year and there's 6, and you look the next year and there's 10. And that's how talent hotbeds are built, by filling the windshield. When your neighbor all of a sudden is on the Olympic team, or your neighbor's a rock star, that changes the windshield for you. And so for the rest of us, the takeaway is to kind of, I think, pay attention to our windshield, you know, as parents, pay attention to it for kids, for ourselves, you know, take some time each day maybe to sort of figure out who are you really staring at? Where exactly do you want to be in 5 years? Where, who do you want to be in 5 years? And use that as kind of a way of tapping into this big latent fuel source that we all have when you really stare at something in the windshield and connect to it in a deep way.
Love it. Love it. And then what about coaching? You have this section about master coaching. So, you know, what are the secrets of the world's most effective coaches, teachers, trainers, coaches? What do they do differently?
You know, I kept meeting the same persons. I traveled around, and for this book, I went, you know, I went to Russia, I went to the Caribbean, I went all over the States, and I kept meeting the same kind of person. And they were slightly older. They weren't the youngest teacher around. They were badasses. And I mean that in the way that they had total knowledge of their domain and could instantly figure out a problem on the fly with somebody. And the other thing they had was this kind of emotional athleticism. They were able to find a way to connect to people very swiftly and very powerfully. And when you think about what a great coach does, I mean, in real time, what they're doing is they're connecting the student is trying something, whether it's an algebra problem or a skateboard trick. And in real time, they are connecting them as a person using this emotional skill, and they're delivering information, like the right information at the right moment. That's a hell of a skill to be able to do those two things.
It takes a hell of a lot of deep practice to be able to do that.
That's exactly right. So you tend to find these people who have maybe spent a lot of time in this domain, maybe failed. That was kind of a common thing, that they were the failed singer or the failed skateboarder who became obsessed with it and became the master teacher. And it really changed, I think, the way I thought about teachers. And I thought about in our culture, we often – there's a lot of teachers who are sort of what I would call friendly waiters. you know, they sort of serve the learner and they try to remove problems and say, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It'll be fine. Let's just keep moving. Let's move past it. And they serve a lot of ice cream, so to speak. And I didn't find that person there. These master teachers had a toughness about them that was different, that set a standard, that challenged the person, asked them if they wanted to be great. Do you want to be great? You know, I want to know. And really built a bond with their learner that was very different than kind of the service-oriented coaching that we see. And they were inspiring. I mean, they were, when you think about teachers, you know, all of us have got teachers in our lives who affected us deeply. You know, it's one of the most powerful positions on the planet. You know, you change people's destinies as a teacher or a coach. Absolutely. And when we reflect on those people, we don't find ourselves thinking of friendly waiters. You know, we find ourselves thinking of kind of badass people, I think, who genuinely challenge us and who genuinely connect with us and who genuinely have deep domain knowledge to connect in real time. And that, you know, I think helps us in some ways, realizing that helps us teach in that way when we're in a position of teaching or parenting, but it also helps us locate those people when we're looking for somebody to be our mentor or to be our coach, you know. And these days, I think, you know, everybody in the world sort of is, I think we're all looking for good mentors and good coaches.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that whole thing about it being challenging is so huge, because it's so funny, because when I first read The Talent Code around about the time our newborn was born, and so my first kid, so I'm trying to learn about, you know, all these different things that I need to do in order to make sure that I do this whole parenting thing properly, you know what I mean? And so one of the books that my wife and I came across was, gosh, I think it's Baby Brain Rules or another book. But anyways, in that book, around the same time I read The Talent Code, the author was saying, look, most parents are going to want to, they're going to want to show their kid exactly how to do something when they're first learning how to do things. Like, you know, putting a puzzle together, yep. You know, dad just comes in and just starts putting the pieces in there when the kid gets confused. If the kid has a jar and they're trying to open it, you know, the parents will just open the jar for them instead of making the kid work hard and enjoy that joy of discovery, right? Like, whoa, I can actually do this. I can actually open the jar if I work hard enough. And I just kept on thinking about The Talent Code, as well as, you know, when I was learning about this whole new idea of not doing stuff for your kids, but just being patient and resisting the urge to do it. Yep. Is so helpful for the child. I'm so glad I picked that up also. And it's a really interesting thing, because it sounds like the kid's building up myelin when they're doing that, right? When they're working harder and they're practicing how to do certain things. And we kind of deprive them of that if we do it for them.
That's right. That's so right. And so true. And it also makes parenting nicer. You know, you're not like, you're not the waiter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're able to kind of say, look, that's your area. This is my, you know, I'm here to support you, which is good. But when it comes to a lot of stuff, you know, it's really on you to do it. And that's the way people get autonomy and ownership.
Absolutely. So another question, very basic question for you, Dan. What's the difference between talent and skill?
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, you know, people talk about talent sort of as synonymous with potential, right? Like, oh, that kid is so talented because, you know, he just is better than his peers at certain things, and therefore we sort of use it as a synonym for having this huge ceiling. I would say there's very little difference between talent and skill. Talent only exists if you can do it, right? Talent is the delivery of skill in a reliable, consistent way. Talent, I would say, is deeper than skill. Talent is the foundation of skill. Skill is the manifestation of talent. But I think we need to use talent as in a more accurate way, which is say stuff you can do, not just stuff you think you can do or think you can grow to do. Because as we look at the science of prodigies, you know, and there's a great deal of deep research where people have taken, look, I'm going to take the 100 brightest kids in America. I'm going to follow them because I think they're going to grow up and be Nobel Prize winners and senators and change the world. And those 100 kids don't. They don't. You know, they were really good when they were 12. And the same is true in the large part with athletics, with art, with math, across the board. being great at a young age is not a great indicator of being a great adult. And part of the reason of that is that being a prodigy is really difficult and sort of a scary place to be. Mm. When your whole world revolves, when your whole world is telling you how brilliant you are, it becomes risky. It becomes hard to take risk. You know, we're status oriented creatures. And so the things that keep you learning are being on the edge of your ability and taking risks. And if you're in a little micro environment where you're constantly told that you're brilliant, you're going to stop wanting to spend time in that difficult place on the edge of your ability.
Developing your skills and developing your talents.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and so the field will catch up with you. So, you know, those prodigies, I think, kind of illustrate how hard it is to really judge who's talented and who's not. And it's funny, a friend of mine just sent me this great commercial with Stephen Curry. Mm-hmm. And we know how brilliant a basketball player he is now. Right, you know, really revolutionizing with his skill. And in the commercial, Steph is reading the scouting report that an NBA scout wrote on him as he left college. And it's unbelievable. The report is like, needs skill in ball handling, isn't athletic enough, can't finish it. Not rely on him on your team, you know, really cautioning anybody from drafting this guy. Now, that is
– sounds like he did him a favor.
He kind of did, right. He did. And so this idea that – you know, and there were plenty of people drafted ahead of Steph Curry. But what they missed was the fact that talent is a construction. Talent is act of construction. And Steph Curry is a builder, you know. I would encourage anybody to go out there. There's a great video on YouTube called Chef Curry's Pregame Recipe, I think it's called. And it's about 7.5 minutes long. And it shows him warming up for a game. And it's incredible to see the amount of focus and intent that he uses. It is not casual. He has built this incredible routine. And if you look at it kind of through the eyes of what's happening in his brain, is he going to the edge of his ability? The answers are as plain as day.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And as far as like practicing goes, so just back to deep practice real quick. Have you ever heard of massed practice versus what's called interleaved practice?
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so I couldn't help but kind of think about Talent Code when I was learning about this. I read a book called Make It Stick from Peter Brown, written by Peter Brown and a couple other guys. And it's a really interesting book just about how the science of learning, right? And retention and making things stick for the long run. And they were talking about those two different things. So what kind of role does myelin play in like massed practice and interleaved practice? Because, you know, the difference, by the way, for you guys listening, so mass practice is like doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, firing off the same, you know, the same circuits, you know, shooting the same exact free throw from the same exact place 100,000 times or 100 times, whatever. And then interleaved is kind of like, you know, shooting jump shots from different parts of the court, shuffling flashcards, switching up the randomizing, you know, quiz questions and practicing that way. So you have an idea of what we're talking about. So what kind of role, Dan, does myelin play in that? Yeah. Like what's
And I'll back up for just a second and say all the science shows that interleaving is a much quicker way to learn than make it stick, to go back to your book. You know, this idea of interleaving, if you do go and shoot 1,000 free throws from 15 feet, you'll be less good than somebody who shoots a few from 5 feet, a few from 10, a few from 15, a few from 20. And the same is true across the board. You know, if you're mixing up your math problems or mixing up some other skill in a systemized way. I saw a study the other day of baseball hitters the same way. It's like you hit all fastballs or mix up fastballs and curves, and you'll be a better hitter if you mix it up. Mm-hmm. The reason is that when you interleave, you're teaching yourself you're building myelin around kind of regulating and controlling the skill in small amounts. When I shoot from 15 feet in blocked practice, like mass practice, like 100 times in a row, I'm sort of doing it exactly the same every time, which can be good, but I'm not able to modulate it. I'm not able to add just that extra bit to get 15 feet in 1 inch. I'm not able to modulate it to get 10 feet. So it builds myelin around modulation. So I can switch from one task to another. I can change and learn to go a little bit lighter or a little bit heavier when I need to. So each task is kind of like moving the camera to a different place. And you get because you're moving the camera, you get to see that skill, that task, in a more complete way.
So it's like tiny little tweaks, focusing on the details.
Exactly, exactly. Seeing it from a bunch of different angles. You know, if you're going to, you know, play a song, you know, you can play it through straight times, or you could break it up into three chunks and then mix those chunks up. And in the end, if you do the latter, it's a little more effortful to interleave. It's hard. It demands some planning. It demands some sort of intention, but it ends up being a much more powerful way to spend your time
over the long run, right?
Yes. Yep.
So the other thing is that you're just to get it straight. So you're building up myelin when you practice. Either way, you're building up more myelin, right? You're firing
right.
off different circuits just in a different way. Is
That's
that right?
Right. Yep.
Cool. Good stuff. Good stuff. Love it, man. Love it. Great big ideas that you shared in this episode. I really appreciate it. A couple of things as we close it out. The final question that I always ask every single one of my guests is a very simple one, but sort of a tough one if you really think about it. And that question is, what does it mean to you specifically to live a meaningful life?
That is a great question. I think it comes down to, I'm sure I will not be the first person to use this word, it comes down to relationships. You know, it comes down to, you know, living in community with people and pursuing something bigger than any individual, and those relationships that get built in pursuit of, you know, in the process of that task, you know, sort of the essential the essential core of the human condition, you know, to be with people, chasing stuff together, and have that chase be about something that's bigger than all of us.
Love it. Love it. And Dan, if they if our listeners want to learn more about you, connect with you, get in touch, what can they do to get in touch with you? Where can they go?
Yeah, I've got, you can go to thetalentcode.com. There's a website there that I'm desperately need to blog a little bit more often, but it's there. It's got all kinds of links and a very deep catalog of previous blogs that people might find interesting.
Awesome. Awesome. And guys, everything that we talked about, the resources, show notes, all that stuff will be available for you over at meaningfulhq.com or getflashnotes.com. So you can get everything we talked about in this episode, in this interview, at either one of those websites. Once again, thanks so much for tuning in, and go out there every single day and live like you give a damn. It's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com. Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.